Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News with some outtakes from Democracy Now!, followed by Independent Native News, and then our further programming at 6 o'clock. Thank you for your patience. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, May 9, 2006, from the studios of KPFK in L.A., I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll hear from Capitol Hill, where lawmakers are considering extending Voting Rights Act provisions. 10 states have filed lawsuits against the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. And we'll take a look at the medical impact of withholding aid from the Palestinian Authority. These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. The Attorney General's Office of Mexico State has filed charges against townspeople arrested in last week's raid of San Salvador Atenco. Some 190 people are charged with organized crime and disrupting a public road. A handful of people, identified as leaders of the People's Front in Defense of the Land, have also been charged with kidnapping. Some of their family members are now in hiding to avoid arrest. Meanwhile, Chilean documentary filmmaker Valentina Palma says that she is planning to take legal action against Mexican officials for her summary deportation and treatment while in police custody after her arrest in Atenco. Palma, whose parents were exiled during Pinochet's regime, gives graphic testimony in today's edition of Mexico's La Jornada newspaper of what she experienced and witnessed during her detention. On reports of police rapes, Palma says, quote, I can say with absolute certainty that various women arrested in Atenco, with whom I was held for 12 hours in the Amoloyita prison, were raped in the course of the transfer from the place of arrest to the jail. More than five, without a doubt. Argentina has petitioned Uruguay for the extradition of six former officers accused of crimes during the era of the Dirty War. Marie Trigona has the story.
The five former military officials and one police official have been placed under arrest in Montevideo for the 1976 kidnapping and disappearance of Claudia Garcia, who was pregnant at the time of abduction. The Argentine military abducted Garcia and her husband and then brought them to Uruguay as part of Operation Condor, a shared plan by regional dictators in Uruguay, Chile, Paraguay, Brazil, Bolivia, and Argentina to kill regime opponents in the 1970s and 80s. Garcia gave birth while in a clandestine detention center and was then killed. Military authorities in Uruguay gave the baby girl to a police family to adopt. A decision on the extradition request could take up to a year. In March, Uruguay's Supreme Court ruled for the first time to extradite Uruguayan officers to Chile. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona.
The humanitarian crisis in Sudan's Darfur region is yet to improve, despite a peace agreement aimed at ending 3 years of fighting in the region. Sema Lakoya reports from Lagos.
The peace agreement signed last week in Nigeria between the Sudanese government and the largest rebel group in the Darfur region provides that humanitarian organizations should have access to the region. But the United Nations top humanitarian official, Jan Hegeland, says this aspect of the peace deal is yet to be respected. The Darfur region is facing one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. More than 2 million of the region's estimated population of 6 million have fled their homes. Many of the refugees are facing starvation after the World Food Program recently cut food rations in half. Despite the peace deal, relief may not come to the refugees anytime soon, although the security situation has improved. An African Union force in the region is ineffective in keeping peace because it is poorly equipped and lacks sufficient manpower. The refusal of two rebel groups to sign the peace deal may also affect the security situation in the region. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Britain's longest peace protest outside Parliament has lost the right to remain protesting outside the country's seat of power. From London, Naomi Feller reports.
Peace protester Brian Hoare has held a 24-hour peace vigil for nearly 5 years outside Parliament. His display has graphic photos of Iraqi children dead, dying or deformed as a result of Western actions against Iraq. The government passed special legislation to get rid of him, banning demonstrations within a mile radius of Parliament without prior police permission. A judge originally upheld his right to continue his protest, but now that's been overturned when the Home Office appealed his decision. Peace protester Brian Hoare from outside Parliament.
They have no water, they have no food in Iraq. They are dying, they are perishing. I came here because my neighbour's kid is as precious as mine. They're trying to shut me up. I'm noisy, apparently. I disturb them. I need to disturb them, don't I?
The first recorded demonstrations outside Parliament were in the 1500s. Suffragettes famously won the vote by chaining themselves to Parliament's railings. Unless this legislation is overturned in the future, Brian Hoare's protest will be the last one to take place here without police authorisation. Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Lawmakers on Capitol Hill heard cautionary testimony about extending Voting Rights Act provisions because the new makeup of the Supreme Court could rule it unconstitutional. This was coupled by lawmakers who say that a full reauthorization places unnecessary burdens on some states. Washington editor Leon Caldwell reports.
A bipartisan, bicameral bill to extend expiring provisions of the Voting Rights Act was introduced in Congress last week. But concerns about key provisions have caused the Senate Judiciary Committee to hold further hearings on the legislation.
Just speaking generally, the court has applied too strict of a standard in terms of the kind of evidence that Congress has to come up with.
Richard Hasten is a law professor at Loyola University. Two Supreme Court decisions have weakened aspects of the Voting Rights Act, and the new conservative Roberts Court could oppose such actions by Congress to restore what the court dismantled. Some testifying before the Judiciary Committee urged caution at passing a bill like the one introduced last week that would extend expiring provisions and restore the act to previous levels. Again, Professor Hasten.
People say, let's just pass this bill as it is. And we'll roll the dice in the Supreme Court. And if the court strikes it down, we'll come back and we'll write something that'll meet the Supreme Court standard. I think there's a danger to that.
But Theodore Shaw with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund says Congress needs to do just that.
Congress should not preemptively weaken the bill because it anticipates that the Supreme Court might strike it down. Pass a strong bill. Have a strong record that supports the bill, you know, have sufficient findings, and then go forward with the bill, and it will be attacked, and we'll be there to try to defend it. The government ought to defend it, and then we'll see what comes out.
Under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, voter jurisdictions that have a history of discriminatory voting practices must get a preclearance from the Department of Justice before any changes in voting procedure is made. 9 states and numerous counties around the country must abide by these regulations. Concern within Congress has also been heard. Republican Senators John Cornyn from Texas and Jeff Sessions from Alabama. They say it is too burdensome to get clearance for each change. Senator Sessions.
Some of the matters that I hear complaints about from district attorneys and county attorneys, maybe, Mr. Hasten, you would comment. For example, if you move a voting place from a school on one side of the street to the courthouse on the other side of the street, the county or the governmental entity must petition the Department of Justice to approve that and demonstrate that it didn't have an intent to discriminate. And at some point, you know, people begin to get a little irritated about that.
Senators Sessions and Cornyn say they support the Voting Rights Act, but think that preclearance provisions are unnecessary because they say there's been so much progress in the past 40 years since the implementation of the Voting Rights Act. Both senators are former attorney generals of their state, in which critics say both have used the law to target people of color. Shaw with the NAACP.
Some say that the act is a victim of its own successes. We caution by looking at the school desegregation experience, we caution what may happen when we remove the protection of the Constitution or civil rights initiatives or laws. There is a danger in backsliding. There is a danger in resegregation of a politics, just as we've seen in resegregation of public schools with the abandonment of desegregation efforts that were vigorously prosecuted and protected by the courts.
Counties have the opportunity to bail out of the preclearance statute if no voter discrepancy complaints have been confirmed in 10 years. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The House of Representatives is expected to pass a bill today that would ban protests at military funerals. Anti-gay protests at service people's funerals spurred the legislation. Demonstrators say that soldiers' deaths are divine retribution for the military's admission of gay people into their ranks. The legislation would ban protests at all military cemeteries, would force protesters to remain 500 feet away from the site of the funeral, and would prohibit protesting 1 hour before and 1 hour after the funeral. But First Amendment advocates say rights could be violated, and the American Civil Liberties Union has filed a lawsuit in Kentucky maintaining that the ban is a violation of the First Amendment. Chip Berlay is with Political Research Associates.
This is a perfect example of why the First Amendment was passed in the first place. It wasn't passed to protect polite speech. It was passed to protect outrageous speech. There's few things more outrageous than showing up at the funeral of a military person and screaming at their families. And this particular church is actually an extended family and a couple of people who are notorious for showing up at funerals and acting in this outrageous way. But, you know, that's what the First Amendment was passed to protect. And as hideous as what they do is obviously apparent to all of us, what's worse is destroying the Constitution and the Bill of Rights in order to make some family feel better in their tragic moment. I think this kind of demonstration is heinous. I think destroying the First Amendment is worse.
Authors of the bill say they crafted it to fit within First Amendment guidelines. The European Union, the United Nations, the U.S., and Russia are meeting in New York this evening to discuss the impact of their decision to withhold aid from the Palestinian Authority following the election of Islamic militants Hamas 2 months ago. The World Bank warned yesterday of the dire economic consequences for the Palestinian population. FSRN's Iris Mackler visited a hospital in the West Bank city of Ramallah, where staff have not been paid for 2 months, and supplies, some medicines and equipment, such as needles and sutures, are starting to run low.
6 weeks ago, the World Bank examined the impact on the Palestinian Authority of the withholding of aid money. International aid comprised about half the authority's annual budget of almost $2 billion, and Israel is withholding tax revenues it collects on the authority's behalf, another $660 million a year. The World Bank concluded that the Palestinian economy would suffer dramatically. But this week, the World Bank has reassessed, saying that even this gloomy prediction was too rosy. The bank says that the Palestinian economy is facing an unprecedented liquidity crisis, which will bring it to the verge of collapse. In the West Bank town of Ramallah today, hidden behind the large concrete wall Israel has built around it, everyone is feeling these effects. After all, 40% of the population are employed by the Palestinian Authority. But these problems are most acute in the publicly funded hospitals. Like all government employees, no one at the main Ramallah hospital has been paid for the past 2 months. Director of Ramallah Hospital, Dr. Hosni Attari, is confident that his staff will continue to work until they can no longer afford to pay for transport into the hospital. But he's concerned that medicines and supplies will run out before then.
We expect in the next few weeks a collapse of the services, even if the staff is there and the beds are there. There's no point in admitting a patient to the hospital if you don't have a suture material to open his abdomen, and you cannot close it, even if you're doing a very successful surgery. The same thing with patients with infection if you don't have the antibiotics.
Dr. Attari says that the hospital is already trying to factor these shortages into its daily management.
Now we start planning to minimize the amount of surgery for the elective patient to keep the sutures for the surgery, for the emergency surgical patients.
However, he estimates that for chronic sufferers, such as patients with cancer and diabetes, subsidized medicines will run out in 6 to 8 weeks. Then patients will have to obtain the drugs privately, and that will cost between 10 and 30 times as much. In the hospital's kidney unit, patients are attached to an electronic dialysis machine to have toxins flushed out of their blood. The doctor says that the medicines required will only last another month or so. 77-year-old Hassan Rashid Mohammed comes three times a week. He's worried because the medicines and injections that he has to take at home have already run out.
Make my blood strong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before we was bite from here, it cost us needle. It cost us 18 shekels.
Yes.
But now, I have to buy it from a drugstore outside. It cost each one 180 shekels.
10 times as much?
Yeah. We didn't have no money that buy that.
The quartet, the United Nations, the EU, the US, and Russia, have to balance a looming humanitarian and economic crisis here with political considerations. Iris Mackler, Free Speech Radio News, Ramallah.
10 states have filed suit against the Federal Environmental Protection Agency for violations of the Clean Air Act. State attorney generals claim the EPA failed to adopt strong emission standards to reduce air pollution from newer power plants across the nation. FSRN's Julie Sabatier reports.
New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer has spearheaded an effort to urge the EPA to take a stronger stand on emissions that contribute to global warming. The case specifically addresses EPA standards for new power plants, which are major producers of carbon dioxide emissions. Judith Enck, policy advisor to Spitzer, explains how this case fits a pattern of shifting state and federal responsibility.
Since President Bush took office, we've seen a dramatic, almost radical change at the Federal Environmental Protection Agency in terms of their unwillingness to enforce existing environmental regulations or to develop new regulations that are sufficiently protective of human health and environmental quality.
Spitzer is joined by attorneys general in California, Connecticut, Maine, and Massachusetts, as well as New Mexico, Oregon, Rhode Island, Vermont, Wisconsin, and the District of Columbia. Stephanie Sodon is the media spokeswoman for Oregon Attorney General Hardy Myers.
There are clear guidelines outlined in the Clean Air Act, and by not regulating specific emissions, such as carbon dioxide, we believe it's a true violation of the Act and the intent of the Act, and feel very strongly that this will be held up, that the judge will rule in our favor and other states' favor.
The Clean Air Act clearly states that the EPA is required to protect and enhance air quality and its effects on human health and welfare. Welfare is defined as including effects on soil, animals, weather, and climate. According to environmental research, power plants are the largest source of carbon dioxide emissions, a primary factor in global climate change. Under current EPA rules, new power plants would face no requirement to control or reduce carbon dioxide emissions.
Climate change is real. It's going to get worse, and the administration's policy of putting its head in the sand and refusing to acknowledge the problem and refusing to do anything about it is, I think, the only word to describe would be criminal.
That's David Bookbinder, senior attorney with the Sierra Club. The Sierra Club, along with the Natural Resources Defense Council and Environmental Defense, are filing in conjunction with the states against the EPA. EPA spokeswoman Jessica Emond had this statement to make regarding the current case against the agency.
EPA will review all options and make an informed decision on how to proceed. EPA's climate protection programs continue to exceed the agency's greenhouse gas emissions goals and are on target to meet the president's 18% goal to reduce greenhouse gas intensity by 2012.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Julie Sabatier.
It's been a tense few weeks in the Solomon Islands, where locals have seen the election of one prime minister, the resignation of two, and massive riots in the nation's capital. From Sydney, Elise Potaka reports on what's behind the unrest.
There's been tentative optimism in the Solomon Islands with the election of opposition candidate Manasseh Sogavare to the position of prime minister. Sogavare's election follows the resignation of former Prime Minister Snyder Rinne, whose election on April 18th sparked violent protests and riots in the nation's capital, Honiara. Many Solomon Islanders believed he'd bought the prime ministership with money from the pockets of Chinese businessmen and felt it was yet another chapter in the Solomon's long history of corruption. The recent unrest is a worrying sign for those who thought the nation was on the road to recovery after the last serious spate of violence, which resulted in international intervention in 2003. The Australian-led Regional Assistance Mission to the Solomon Islands, or RAMSI, has since that time remained in the Solomons. And despite the recent riots, the Australian government is still hailing the mission's success.
This obviously has been a setback, but I think the fact is that a tremendous amount of progress has been made.
Speaking on ABC Radio, Australia's Foreign Minister Alexander Downer says they've had a lot of success tackling issues like civil disobedience and corruption. But there are others who believe that RAMSI, under the guidance of the Australian government, is doing little to tackle the underlying problems.
The RAMSI force, they've done a good job of restoring law and order, but the reason that it's unravelled so quickly is that they've gone in without kind of a long-term strategy to kickstart the Solomon's economy to get jobs going.
Susan Windybank from Sydney-based think tank the Centre for Independent Studies says the issues of high unemployment and a lagging economy have largely been overlooked.
In the Solomon Islands, you have a population of about 500,000 people, and you have about 80 to 100,000 people who don't have work. The real problem, I think half of it lies in Canberra, in that they've gone in without an economic roadmap for recovery.
The Solomon Islands economy is largely resource-based, but Susan Windybank says it's not providing jobs to local people.
It's not the kind of foreign investment that leads to widespread job creation. You only need a small number of people for that kind of industry.
There have also been concerns about the spending of Australia's aid money in the Solomons, a figure of about $250 million per year. Tim O'Connor from local NGO AidWatch.
One of our main criticisms is most of that money is being spent in Honiara and is not getting out to where most of the actual poverty is.
Tim O'Connor says much of the aid money is being spent propping up the government, not in the regional areas where health, education and sometimes even food are still lacking. He also says there's a problem with aid money not staying in the Solomons.
A lot of that money comes back to Australia via what we call boomerang aid in profits to Australian companies, but also very large salaries to Australian consultants that work for those companies.
Australia's Foreign Minister Alexander Downer is dismissive of criticism, especially of his RAMSI forces, and he's now playing down Australia's future role in the Solomons.
Ultimately, the responsibility for the destiny of the Solomon Islands rests with the Solomon Islands people. We don't run the Solomon Islands, we are assisting them.
What the near future holds for the Solomon Islands is unclear, but there are many who are hoping new Prime Minister Manase Sogavare can bring the nation to a point where it's able to stand on its own two feet. For Free Speech Radio News in Sydney, I'm Elise Bataka.
Teachers' pay was the cause of concern for African civil society organizations during this year's Global Week of Action to highlight the plight of educators. Teachers are some of the least paid laborers in Africa, and activists say this will likely affect government's visions of attaining education for all by 2015. The Global Week of Action is a worldwide annual activity implemented by NGOs and teachers' unions in more than 150 countries as part of a broader undertaking to realize the right to education for all. FSRN's Joshua Chilimpa reports.
In Uganda, teachers have to make less than $100 a month, or 140,000 Uganda shillings. The teachers, on top of the poor pay, have to teach in crowded classrooms because the teacher pupil ratio is about 120 pupils to one teacher. The conditions for a Ugandan teacher are not any different from those of other teachers from most countries in the sub-Saharan region. Fred Mwesigo of the Forum for Education NGO says the situation for teachers in Africa continues to deteriorate due to the budgetary constraints imposed by the respective ministries of finance of each African country.
Today, as one stumbling block to access to education called school fees and other charges has been removed, there is another stumbling block. There is another barrier called the budgetary ceiling, whereby the Minister of Finance will not allow the Minister of Education to spend according to their needs, but spend according to what the Minister of Finance thinks will be good enough to keep the macroeconomic stability in balance, to avoid inflation and so on and so forth. You cannot say you want education but not put your money there. You have to put your money.
Last week, civil society organizations in the field of education met during the Global Week of Action in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. More than 1,000 teachers, about 10% of Uganda's educators, leave Uganda for better working conditions every year. The teachers who stay in Uganda are crossing over to other professions, creating a shortage of educators to fill the local schools. Top Minister Mayanja of the Uganda National Teachers Union says Africa cannot realize the dream of having uneducated citizenry if the plight of teachers is not addressed.
There is no way we are going to realize quality education unless we have put attention to the teachers. With all the provisions and the facilities made, we are very grateful. We do have the facilities. There's quite a lot of classroom construction, provision of instructional materials. To some extent, the communities have been mobilized, and indeed they have sent the learners to school, including our girls, but who continue to drop from the hands of the teachers. So it is important now to get concerned that it is now the teacher to whom we have got to pay the attention in order for our children to realize the quality education we want.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
80% of New Orleans and virtually all of neighboring St. Bernard Parish flooded when the levees breached after Hurricane Katrina. The flooding damaged or destroyed more than 100,000 homes, and the land beneath them was awash in toxic discharges containing heating oil, gasoline, battery acid, and various dangerous chemicals, all of which before the hurricane gave the area around New Orleans the undesirable title of Cancer Alley. But a pilot project in some of the hardest-hit areas aims to clean up the soil by planting flowers. From New Orleans, FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
In Orleans and St. Bernard parishes alone, more than 600 square miles of land area was underwater for days or weeks following Katrina. The job of cleaning up that much soil seems gargantuan and even hopeless. But into this grim scene come the volunteers of Common Ground Relief, a grassroots operation set up in Katrina's wake. Its Healthy Soil Project is working to extract toxins from the soil, especially lead and arsenic. Randy Schaefer is one of the coordinators of this bioremediation project based at one of the few houses left standing in the Lower Ninth Ward. As earth-moving machines pile up debris just outside the house, Schaefer explains the process.
The first step we do is aerate the soil. Basically, it's just been really compacted. There is just like an oily film all over everything and kind of sealed off the soil. It became anaerobic. The reason it smelled bad is there's all this nasty bacteria in there, the kind you don't want in your soil.
Schaefer says knowing which toxins are in the soil is key to knowing how to get them out. Volunteers have collected soil samples and also looked at data collected by government and independent scientists. Then they treat the soil according to the results they get.
What we're doing is using plants, fungi, and bacteria in different capacities. Basically, we're speeding up and concentrating natural processes that already occur to either absorb or break down contaminants.
Schaefer says the plants most effective at drawing lead and arsenic out of the soil are sunflowers and Indian mustard. The plants can then be disposed of. The alternative is excavation to remove the whole top layer of soil and take it to a landfill, an expensive undertaking that leaves the soil still contaminated. She shows off several trays of tiny seedlings perched on an old wagon at project headquarters. Wilma Subra is a Louisiana native and chemist who conducted tests showing the post-Katrina environment was more toxic than the Federal Environmental Protection Agency had indicated. She points out that even though successive plantings must be made to draw enough toxins from the soil to make it safe, bioremediation is a viable approach.
Well, I think it's very applicable to the situation down there. It's not something that you could use over the entire area, but in specific areas, it works very well. On small scales or in areas where you can't get in heavy equipment or where you can limit the traffic, the foot traffic, so that people don't walk through it and destroy the vegetation.
The project has 9 test plots in 4 neighborhoods, including one at an AIDS hospice, to which its displaced residents hope to return one day. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Orleans.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Ara Bogado.
And I'm Lisa Loving. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Due to technical, we'll say opportunities, incredible things happening in the station today. We are not having our normal news broadcast, and I'm going to follow up right now with a special outtake from today's Democracy Now! Program, Chicago's Abu Ghraib UN Committee Against Torture. Here's a report on how police tortured over 135 African-American men inside Chicago jails. Do stay tuned. At 6:30, we'll have Prison Pipeline. I'm Lisa Loving. This is the KBOO News. And please hold on. We're going to play a special feature from Democracy Now!
Where we're joined by three guests, David Bates, Flint Taylor, and John Conroy. David Bates is one of dozens of men to come forward with allegations of abuse at the hands of the Chicago police. Flint Taylor is an attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago, which he helped found in the late 1960s. He's represented many of the torture victims and was directly involved in spearheading the special prosecutor's investigation. And John Conroy is a journalist and author who's covered the case for over a decade. He's written several articles for the Chicago Reader and is the author of the book Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! I want to begin with Flint Taylor for an overview. You have been working on this case for years. You represented people who said they were tortured. Give us the scope of this story.
Well, the scope started out with one man who was tortured by electric shock and having a plastic bag put over his head and being beaten by John Burge and others at the Area 2 police station. He, on his own, brought a lawsuit in the mid-80s. That lawsuit we got involved in, and over the years we were able to uncover, with the help of journalists and such as John Conroy, others such as David Bates, who had also been tortured and had told their stories in various courts, but no one had put all this evidence together. We were able to assimilate over 60 cases of torture. And when I say torture, I mean electric shock. I mean suffocation with bags. I mean mock executions. I mean racial attacks, that kind of thing. And they were all coming out of the same station, and they were all headed up by this man, John Burge, who came out of Vietnam, started out as a detective, and quickly rose in the ranks through sergeant, lieutenant, and commander. This went on, the actual documentation now shows that this went on for over 20 years, from 1972 to 1992, when in fact Burge was finally, after community outrage, suspended and fired from his job. As you said, he has never been prosecuted. The state's attorney of Cook County at the time this evidence first came to light in the mid-80s was none other than the now mayor, Richard Daley. The superintendent of police at that time contacted him with the evidence of torture and said, "Are you going to prosecute this?" Daley did not intervene or prosecute at that time. Later on, his first assistant, Richard Devine, became state's attorney of Cook County. Remarkably, Devine, while he was in private practice, had been Burge's lawyer defending many of these civil cases. He then became prosecutor in 1997. Of course, he did nothing either, because his clients were the ones that needed to be investigated. So for 20, 25, 30 years, no one in the prosecutor's office, the current mayor, the current state's attorney, no one else did any investigation. Finally, the community outrage was so strong with regard to all of that a special prosecutor was appointed. That was 4 years ago, as you said. 4 years of investigation has led to his publicly saying that he now has 192 cases of torture and abuse at Area 2 and later at the Area 3 station where Burge was transferred to later on. He now is talking about releasing a report. He still is not talking about indicting anybody. The rumor has it that because it is so long, that we're going to have a catch-22 situation, and we're going to have the statute of limitations invoked by the special prosecutor, who's going to release a report but say it's too late to indict anybody. Of course, we all say that, that's ridiculous, that there are ongoing conspiracy allegations and evidence, that there's an obstruction of justice going on in the various courts, there's perjury going on. So no one's going to be satisfied if, in fact, all that happens is a report, no matter how damning the report may be. So the struggle here in Chicago continues and will continue as long as people are still in jail because of the confessions that were tortured from them, and as long as Burge and others sit in Florida and other places and collect hundreds of thousands and even millions of dollars in police pensions rather than to face criminal charges, whether they be state charges, federal charges, or charges before the International Court of Justice.
We are also joined by David Bates. Can you tell us what happened to you? When did it happen? Tell us the whole course of events.
Well, I believe it was October 28th or 29th, 1983, when a few officers knocked on my mom's door and announced that they were police officers and let my mom know that I'll be taken away and that I'll be coming home shortly. There was supposed to be some questions regarding the case. Of course, I got to the police station. I was questioned. Let the officers or the detectives know that I had nothing to do with the case. I knew nothing. This went on for 2 days. At that time, it was five sessions of torture, starting with two slaps and kicks and threats. It was two particular sessions of torture that was very devastating, which a plastic bag was placed over my head. I was punched and kicked, and I tell you, when you talk about torture, you're talking about individuals who most part were young, had few brushes with the law, but never in a million years thought that they would have a plastic bag placed over their head. More importantly, the torture has never been resolved. No one has ever owned up to the torture. So we have hundreds of individuals who have psychologically been warped, been destroyed. There's never been any clinical resolution to the torture. No one has owned up to it. And I tell you, the fact that this attorney and this journalist has spent years trying to uncover the truth, and community organizations and individuals, and we're talking about a city, we're talking about a state, we're talking about legislators who have not looked into the issue of torture. And I say it's a shame. And I'd like to commend these gentlemen for working hard to bring the issue of torture out. But I say it's time for the legislators, the mayor, and individuals who had firsthand knowledge of it to come clean with it and bring these individuals to justice.
Flint Taylor, I remember years ago with an especially active group of mothers in Chicago of men on death row, who kept raising the issue of this police commander, Burge, and saying that their sons had been tortured, that one had engraved in a metal bench in the police station, I am tortured, I'm forced to confess, something like that. What about this? What about the death row cases where men ended up on death row?
Well, that's been a major, major piece of this whole struggle against police torture. In the early and mid-90s, the movement against police torture and for human rights came together with the anti-death penalty movement here in Chicago and raised a very strong set of voices, some of whom you've just mentioned. For people, there were at least 10 to 12 people on death row here in Illinois who alleged and had evidence to show that Burge and his men had tortured them into giving confessions, one of whom was Aaron Patterson, whom you just mentioned, who during a break in one of his torture sessions etched in a bench that he'd been suffocated with a bag and was being tortured. That later came out. Ultimately, due to the combination of the factors and articles that John wrote and speaking out by David and others in the community and the work of various lawyers, Governor Ryan looked at all of these cases, and as you know, he not only commuted the sentence of all of those on death row, some 160 odd people, but he looked specifically at four cases of torture by Burge and others, and found that those individuals were innocent, that they had been tortured into giving false confession, and he gave full innocence pardons to those four individuals. That's Aaron Patterson, Stanley Howard, Madison Hobley, and Leroy Orange. Those four men are now fortunate enough, and I put that with quotes around it, to be able to, because they've been exonerated, bring lawsuits in federal court. So there is not only the special prosecutor, but there are these lawsuits by the individuals who have been pardoned in federal court, where we are fighting the issues of torture and bringing out evidence in that forum as well. And there's an obstruction of justice going on in that courtroom as well as against the special prosecutor, as the city has paid over $5 million to a set of private lawyers to represent the police officers, including Burge, in all these cases. Burge and his men, and there's now over 50 detectives that are named in one or more of these 192 cases. They're all getting free lawyers, and they're getting the advice from the city paid lawyers to take the Fifth Amendment. So you now have the spectacle of, in these federal cases and in front of the special prosecutor, that former and present law enforcement officers, rather than to answer questions about whether they tortured and abused people like David Bates and the men on death row, they have all lined up and taken the Fifth Amendment as to each and every allegation of police torture.
John Conroy, you're a journalist and author. You've covered the torture case for over a decade for the Chicago Reader, and you wrote the book Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture. How has this taken so long to come out, though it has come out in parts over the years and in certain communities well known? And now the question of whether, in fact, it will be released, this report that, among other people calling for this, four black aldermen are calling for the public release of this report.
Well, it hasn't taken that long to be out. It was out in 1990 when we did the story in the Chicago Reader. The first story, and we've done more than 100,000 words since. And I think that what's dragged on, the reason why it's dragged on, I differ with the estimable Mr. Taylor here on this, is that there is no community outrage. People don't care. As in every society in which people are tortured, there's a torturable class in Chicago. It's African-American men, most of them with criminal records. And they're just beyond the pale of our compassion. We just don't care. And that's why it's taken 15 years for you probably to do this program, and many others now interested in this report, when the information has been out there for a very long time. The New York Times, I think, has covered this twice. Once when the men were pardoned, and once when there was a float in a St. Patrick's Day parade that was going to honor four of the officers who had been accused, and the float never came to be in the parade, but there was a controversy about it. So that shows you, I think, the level of concern in the United States about this issue.
We're talking to John Conroy, author of Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, and the Dynamics of Torture. We're also joined by David Bates, a torture victim, and Flint Taylor, an attorney who has worked on this case for decades. We'll be back with them in a minute.
Freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers, sons. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We believe
sing it with us. Come on.
We believe in freedom and freedom to
Ella Song, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests in the Chicago studio are John Conroy, who is a journalist and author, covered the torture case for over a decade for the Chicago Reader, author of Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture. David Bates is also with us, as is Flint Taylor, attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago. David Bates, are you going to sue the police department?
Well, I have to consult my attorney regarding that. I'll just have to say that in conjunction with what Flint said and John, this has been going on for so long, and there hasn't been the outrage needed to bring attention to the torture in order to get those convictions. But again, I just want to commend individuals who have been tirelessly working to keep this issue of torture in the news. We have to look at this as a human, from a human perspective. These are individuals who were tortured and beaten at the hands of people who basically were supposed to serve and protect them. And imagine keeping this thing and not being able to talk to people about this. A lot of these gentlemen went to prison and served long stints of time incarcerated. It was no one to talk to about the torture. Even contacting public officials or community leaders, it wasn't no one to talk to about it. And again, I just want to commend everybody for coming on board with this issue, but it's a lot need to be done.
David Bates, did you hear about this happening to other people at the time that this happened to you?
Well, no. See, the problem comes in is that when you're in prison and you're in an environment like, you know, that you made a confession, whether you were tortured, however you made the confession, it was not in your best interest to expose that while you were in prison. You would be considered weak. So imagine these individuals in prison, not able to even seek legal help and advice. I liken it to being raped, honestly. The individuals not even go for help. Then when you did go for help, when you had the opportunity to go for help, people said it didn't happen. So I tell you, when you get rid of all, when you get down to the human aspect of this problem, you're going to deal with a lot of sick men, a lot of sick men that need clinical, some type of clinical help to deal with the torture.
David Bates, when you saw the pictures at Abu Ghraib, what were your thoughts?
Well, the pictures, I'll say this, my thoughts on the whole process was, how the hell did they get hearings? And torture from anywhere is wrong. But as we've spoken on, this torture has taken place for over 2 to 3 decades in America, on the south side of Chicago. Why didn't we have public hearings? Why didn't the state legislators come in and do investigations? We actually had to go outside the country to international court to deal with police torture. October 14th, the People's Law Office other attorneys met in front of the Organization of American States to bring attention to the issue of torture. And we're looking for a delegation of individuals to come in and ask Mayor Daley questions that he haven't been able to answer to the public since this John Birch stuff has been going on. And I tell you, it's going to be an embarrassment to a lot of people. But like my good friend Conroy said, they've been known about it.
Well, let me ask about the knowledge to the very top. Some are saying, and I want to put this question to Flint Taylor, attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago, that the report could well implicate, as you were talking about, the state's attorney, Richard Daley, his assistant, Richard Devine, who now holds the top job. Can you talk more about how they knew, the whole issue of them being told early on?
Well,
Well, as I said, Richard Daley was previously the state's attorney of Cook County. In 1982, when the first major case broke with regard to police torture, the Andrew Wilson case, the superintendent of police was informed by the head of the hospital, the prison hospital where Andrew Wilson was being held, that there was serious evidence of torture, that Andrew Wilson not only said but had physical evidence that supported the conclusion that he'd been tortured by electric shock, by beating, and he had 15 injuries all over him, burns and everything like that. And the head of the hospital was so shocked, he brought it straight to the superintendent of police. The superintendent of police then brought it straight to Richard Daley. He knew that Andrew Wilson had been charged with very serious offenses, shooting two police officers and killing them. So Daley decided that rather than to investigate the criminal activities of John Burge in torturing Andrew Wilson, that would in fact undercut and undermine, he thought, the prosecution of Wilson, so he did nothing. He did no prosecution at that time. He then presided over the next 8 years over the state's attorney's office, which was complicit in taking over 55 confessions from 55 different victims of Burge and police torture. In all of those, or many of those cases, in the individual courts, there was testimony from those victims that they'd been tortured. However, Daley defended all those cases, put all those people behind bars, many of them on death row, and in no instance did he investigate the continuing allegations that were coming out of Burge's police headquarters that people were tortured. Daley then went on to be the mayor of the city of Chicago. There was and John and I disagree in the sense that there have been at times public outrage. The public outrage reaches certain proportions at different times. We're at one of those key points again today. We had been in the early 90s, and one of the reasons for that was this Andrew Wilson trial that brought out all of this evidence and put together all these different allegations of torture. Because of all of that, the police department was forced to reinvestigate. They put, this is in the early 90s, they put an honest investigator in charge of the investigation, and lo and behold, he came to an obvious conclusion. He said there was systematic torture at Area 2. He said he had looked at 50 cases and there was systematic torture. Well, what did the superintendent of police do? He suppressed that report. He then met with the mayor of the city of Chicago after we had gotten the police gotten that report released by a judge, and he and the mayor, who is now Richard Daley, instead of saying, now we have the evidence to prosecute, now we should proceed, now we should lock Burge up, what did they do? They not only attempted to suppress the report, but then they went publicly and discredited it. Daley stepped forward and said, these are only rumors and innuendo. So at every point, as I've mentioned, Daley, rather than taking his responsibility as chief law enforcement officer and chief executive officer of the city of Chicago, moved to suppress and to do nothing. And
legally,
again,
let me ask you, Flynn Taylor, legally, if crimes are known about and they are covered up, is Mayor Daley criminally liable?
Well, at this point, is he criminally liable? I suppose you could see him as a co-conspirator and a certain obstruction of justice over the years, certainly. But I think at this point what we're looking at is if a special prosecutor comes out with a report and says, I can't indict because it's too late, then the people of the city of Chicago have to look in two directions. They have to look backwards to Daley and Devine and say, well, the special prosecutor was hamstrung by the fact that Daley and Devine didn't act when they should have, and then we have to look forward and say, that's not sufficient, that's not right. There are continuing criminal violations here, and if the special prosecutor won't do anything about them, then Fitzgerald, who is the U.S. attorney here, and who of course has made his name in the Valerie Plame case, and has already indicted Daley's people in a wide-ranging truck scandal, he has to open his investigation into federal RICO or racketeering racketeering charges, as well as obstruction of justice and perjury. And as David has mentioned, it has been taken to the International Forum, not only last fall to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is the organization of American states who is still looking into this issue, but this past week and right now, it's been presented to the Committee Against Torture of the United Nations in Geneva. And one of our people has spoken with and presented evidence to the Committee Against Torture, and that committee has ordered the government to respond and to speak to the issues of torture here in this country. And in its concluding remarks, it put with Abu Ghraib and put with Guantanamo the situation of Chicago. And so perhaps there's not enough public outrage here, but the international community and is looking at it in a very strong way. And to hear Chicago put in the same breath with Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib is something that, if that doesn't wake up the powers that be here in the city of Chicago, and that doesn't wake up the U.S. Attorney's Office, and that doesn't, in fact, put on the carpet the state's attorney of Cook County and the mayor of the city of Chicago, I don't know what will.
John Conroy, the Midwest Coalition for Human Rights, will present a report that includes the Chicago torture allegations to the UN Human Rights Commission. How significant is this? And finally, why do you call your book Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People?
Well, let me take the second question first. I call the book Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People because torture is always done by, we want our tortures to be monsters, but it turns out that they're just ordinary people like you and me. And I can go back and cite you all kinds of psychological experiments that in which they have found that people will do extraordinary things, inflicting pain on other people, if they are simply ordered to do so, simply following orders someone else is taking responsibility. And it doesn't require any sort of a twisted mind to do this. We are all, most of us are given to obedience. And so if I've interviewed torturers from around the world, former torturers, and they all struck me as very ordinary men. How significant the international attention will be remains to be seen. It's a unique turn, and it's somewhat thrilling, I think, for those of us who've been watching this for a long time to see it finally raised to the level of being mentioned in a phrase with Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. But whether this will just be one of those media, you know, where the media comes in for a day or two and then leaves, remains to be seen.
And what's the timetable on this?
The special prosecutor is supposed to, the judge who oversees the special prosecutor is supposed to rule, I believe, on the 12th of May as to whether the report will be released or not.
That will be Friday, and we will certainly follow it up. I want to thank you all for being with us. David Bates, torture victim himself, telling his own story. Flint Taylor, attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago, who has represented many of the torture victims. And John Conroy, who's written about this for years for the Chicago Reader, author of Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture.
And you are tuned into KBOO Portland. I'm Lisa Loving, evening news director. Because of circumstances beyond our control, we were not able to have our normal news broadcast, but stay tuned tomorrow night. All of our real life people will be back, not something in a can. And stay tuned for Independent Native News coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7:30. Barbara Bernstein hosts Candidates Forum for City Council Position Number 3, the Dan Saltzman seat at 9. It's Movie Talk at 9:30. Miriam Widman interviews historian Estelle Friedman on feminism here and abroad. At 10, Scott Forrester sits in on People Rise Up. And at 11, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. 6 o'clock, we're going to listen to the Queer Boo Collective special show. And then at 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Stay tuned. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 9th of May. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Over 200 soldiers visited a dozen Western Alaska villages last month to provide medical, dental, vision, and veterinary services. Operation Arctic Care blends several military and public health divisions to give medical attention not readily available in remote locations. From KNOM in Nome, Amy Flaherty has more.
During the first 2 weeks in April, five military Black Hawk helicopters regularly departed Nome to transport 20 medical teams and their equipment to and from Norton Sound villages. Soldiers and professionals from around the United States offered free expertise to locations usually served by only a few health aides. Pediatrician David Bush says he received a warm welcome in Shaktulik, an Alaska Native village of about 200 people.
Patients were very friendly and very excited to have us here, and we tried to do the best that we could in the situation that we had. And more importantly, we were able to help work with the health aides that are in the villages and the wonderful job that they do in taking care of the people that are in their respective villages.
Because many of these services aren't available all the time, Lydia Jackson, a health aide in Shaktulik, appreciates the medical assistance it provides her village.
Majority of the community went to utilize the services, especially the eye care team, I think. Because the eye care team at the Norton Sound Health Corporation, they only come once a year. It was nice to have another eye care team come into town to provide services. I just thought it was a really neat operation going, and I hope they come back again.
This year, the Navy flew in specialized equipment to make 1,000 pairs of free eyeglasses. Lieutenant Colonel Walt Stanish of Joint Task Force Alaska says veterinarians went door-to-door administering important vaccinations.
And it was brought to our attention there was a need for veterinary support out in the villages, with the only veterinarian being in Nome. So something that we're glad to do, and helps the animals out in the villages, but it also helps us as the military for our veterinarians to come out and do some work under field conditions.
Stanish estimates Operation Arctic Care cost the military about $1.2 million this year. The military gains cold weather and field experience in providing this humanitarian mission. In Nome, Alaska, I'm Amy Flaherty.
In northwestern Wisconsin, the Lakutareo Ojibwe Community College recently put on a play called Post about flooding the Chippewa River for electricity. Post is the name of an Anishinaabe village inundated in 1922 by building a hydroelectricity dam. Creating the Chippewa flowage, the process also devastated Anishinaabe culture. Nick Vanderpie from the Superior Broadcast Network reports.
The sprawling 30,000-acre Chippewa flowage today is a sportsman's dream, hosting big-money fishing tournaments and plush second homes. But before the Chippewa River was dammed by Northern States Power for electricity, the place was known as Pequewang. Pequewang means where the river is wide. Pequewang was covered with wild rice beds, maple sugar bush, and thousands of graves. A 29-year-old Lakutare Chippewa tribal member, Jason Schlender, explains why he plays a tribal elder in the play Post about Pequewang.
My stepmother's family is from New Post, and her family is obviously impacted by what happened.
Schlender talks about the lessons of the play, Post.
That we find something to build on, and we make something positive out of it, you know, instead of feeling sorry for ourselves or, you know, making an excuse for not succeed, we can use that as a tool, and so we can make something of ourselves and, you know, say that and make a commitment to ourselves and our community, our families, that we won't let something like that ever happen again.
The Lakutare tribe is trying to restore wild rice on the reservation. On the Lakutare Reserve in northern Wisconsin, I'm Nick Vanderpie.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C., defending Native American interests since 1976. And by Ridolfi Incorporated, designing and implementing restorative community development. RIDOLFI.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Good evening. You're listening to KBOO 90.7, and the time is 4 minutes after 6 o'clock.
Join us this Friday at 6 p.m. for Bread and Roses, the power of the princess.
Join us as we discuss the Princess Icon and its power to captivate the imaginations of girls across generations, shaping perceptions of self, womanhood, and destiny. Now a billion-dollar business, what messages are passed down?
We'll also take a humorous and analytical look at this country's own princess icon, Miss America.
That's this Friday at 6 p.m. on KBOO.
I want to be princess.
Hey, that's my crown.
No, it's mine.